Michigan HockeyCast 4.12, where we'll be ready to talk about hockey on a minute's notice. I think we have some things to talk about.
Well, we took a time off from the show because we didn't think there was going to be anything going on for a little while, and then lots of things went on.
Right. I suppose we probably could have had a show last week, but it would have been
It would have just minor. Been us talking about Western.
and maybe some Michigan Tech?
Something like that, yes.
Okay, well, you wanted to talk about Western, which we'll get into in a minute, but the first thing we probably need to do is when we left off, Michigan had no players because they were all at the WJC.
It was actually only five guys at the World Juniors, which was lower than I remembered in my head,
like,
but I was
12.
Researching it for my piece today, and I was like, I thought it was like eight, and then it was actually five.
Well... But. Bortolo was probably going to go.
Bortolo, yeah, that would have been
something
six.
Happened, and Truscott.
Truscott
went to
the
camp.
Truscott
was
at the camp.
And
got
that's
cut.
Probably it. So it would have been seven.
Yeah.
But it felt like 10 watching Michigan's Ohio State series and then the Tech game, which we'll get into in a minute. We haven't done that. So the World Juniors, the U.S. wins their first game. Like, well, I don't know. I went to bed in the third. It was like 2-0.
They won, I think, that was against Slovakia, right?
Yes.
They won that one, I think, 3-2.
Oh, it got close.
I think it got close at the end. Well, Slovakia is very interesting because they haven't produced any talent since the breakup of Czechoslovakia. So, like, if you look back at 2010, they were, I think, took fourth in that Olympics. But if you look at their roster for that Olympics... All of the guys were like early 70s to late 70s birthdays.
So it was like all of the old Czech Republic guys?
More or less, yes. And my understanding is that the hockey infrastructure in that country was all in the Czech side and not the Slovak side.
Wow, so that's they, what it sounds like.
So it was like their roster that time was like Gaborik, Hossa, Chara... Ziggy Palfy, like a bunch of guys from a long time ago who are now gone, Pavel Dimitra, a few others. But anyway, so now they've been in basically the wasteland for like 10 years. But this draft has one Slovak player in the top 10 of most rankings. And next year they've got two borderline top 5 prospects. So within a year or two, that Slovak team might be a World Junior medal contender with this little age group of guys. So that's a fascinating thing to watch.
So the U.S. beat them barely at the end.
Yeah, well, because this year, since those guys aren't even draft eligible yet, and this is a U-20 tournament,
yeah.
Their whole roster was like 17-year-olds.
Yeah.
So within a few years, they'll age into it, but they weren't quite ready for prime time.
The other thing of note is Canada played, I think, one or two games. I can't remember, but Owen Power scored more goals than games played.
He had a hat trick in
yeah.
the one game.
Did you throw your hat?
No, I only saw his first goal.
You don't wear a lot of hats, do
I
you?
I don't wear hats, no.
No. I wear hats.
Except a nice hat with a suit.
Like a fedora? I have a fedora. I wore a fedora for Christmas.
We've discussed this. It's never made it on the podcast, but society went downhill when men stopped wearing hats with suits.
But you mean like fedora hats, not
yeah,
like
yeah, like you see in
hat.
Like a yeah. 1940s movie where the man comes into the room, he takes off his coat and his hat,
and
like
hangs
that.
His hat up.
Yeah,
on
yeah,
the,
that
yeah,
that's classic.
Okay, that's interesting. We should do a video cast or like a video in which you could just wear suits and hats. Would we have to wear canes? Did you mean canes are kind of like the an added piece to that ensemble?
That's only if you're old. I'm talking
like
a
walking.
I'm talking
like
a 1940s detective.
Like a monocle know? Is the same thing, right? Like we could do.
Yeah, if you're the penguin.
When we talk about hockey, there are penguins. Anyway, so that's pretty much it for anything that actually happened during the World Juniors, right? Like, because then the U.S. forfeited Game 2, and then the next day the whole thing was scrapped.
So, the IIHF has been. really exposed in the past month. Because first off, they moved to cancel the women's championship for the second straight year. And like didn't even make an attempt, or were not going to make an attempt to reschedule. Since then, they've now strangely changed their mind after tons of outrage. And then, just only a few days later, the whole World Juniors falls apart, which we learned was basically the cause of two things. Number one, they decided that this was going to be a zero COVID tournament, in that if you have any positive tests that handicap your ability to play, you forfeit, right? So they're like, we can't have any cases of this tournament falls apart. But we're not bubbling. We're just going to have the players out normally. When they did a bubble last year and the tournament went fine. So to me, that was extremely illogically inconsistent, right? It's either you say we can have some positive tests and we won't bubble, or we have to bubble because we don't want any positive tests. But you can't do both. Especially after they had several weeks window into the pro leagues, which made it very clear by the point of the tournament starting that, like, if you make any attempt to live a normal life, you're going to get the Omicron variant, right? Like, every NHL team had tons of positive cases. So they knew this was a risk. And yet...
So did they, like, undermine themselves?
Well, you know, I think
that's part of it. They just not want to have the tournament?
Well, so the interesting thing about it is they... Apparently, a big reason why this kind of went down in flames was they were staying at a hotel, because the tournament was in Edmonton and it was in Red Deer.
So those are both in Western Canada.
Those are both in Alberta, yes. Yeah. Red Deer is the stopover city between Calgary and Edmonton when you're driving north from Calgary. Well, anyway, the players in Red Deer apparently were staying at a Marriott that was hosting a wedding. And the players were mingling with the wedding guests, like, in the lobby.
Sure.
And they were not, the hotel was not, this wasn't just like, this is the players' hotel. It was just like, we just booked 20 rooms at the hotel. And so players were staying in hotel rooms, you know, with the maid coming in and coughing on them, and the person next door throwing their pizza box in the hallway.
Do you think they were actually in the room when the maid came? It's like, that's happened to me before, and I'm usually like, I'm not ready to have this room cleaned.
But the point is, they basically put the players out with the general public, and the general public was not doing any of the things that you need to run a zero COVID tournament. And so you could see how this was going to fall apart weeks in advance, and apparently the people organizing yet didn't see that.
I don't really have a lot of comments with this. I mean, it doesn't seem to make a lot of
sense. My only comment is, who in the world gets married in December in Red Deer, Alberta?
Well, but isn't that a thing, though? People like to get married on New Year's Eve?
So the argument it wasn't New Year's Eve. It was, like, December 27th.
Okay, but you asked me, like, who gets married in December, and that was
It's one thing to get married in December. It's another thing to get married in December in Red Deer.
Well, if you're going to get married, Red Deer probably, like, get married. I mean, they don't...
If you're going to get married in Red Deer, do it in the summer or the spring or the fall. Not, like, the time of year when it's -5 degrees outside.
But they're Canadian, right? Like, it's, like, just part of their life.
So the argument I always heard about getting married in December is that you... Which is... I don't know if the... They said the reception was at the Marriott. I don't know if the actual wedding was at the Marriott.
Where are you finding all this data on this wedding?
But the argument I always heard was that you get married in late December at a church because then you don't have to pay for flowers because the church just has decor from Christmas.
Sure.
So you can, you know,
yeah,
get cheap flowers from that. But anyway, whoever it was that got married in Red Deer in December can make one of those wedding scrapbooks. Like, look, we coughed on Maddie Beniers in the lobby. Here's a little photo.
They, like, are in the wedding photo pictures. And
yeah, here's...
wedding photos.
Here's Brendan Brisson doing the cha-cha slide with Grandma and Uncle
Spoiler
Joe.
Spoiler alert, like, he did the gritty going through, like, the celebration line or after one of his goals. Anyway. So that's the first part of our news. The second part is how Michigan only played one game in the GLI, and there were very strong opinions on... said game? Said non-game?
So, the Western thing... Let's do a quick recap of what happened. On December 27th, Michigan tweets out, our game against Western Michigan on December 30th has been canceled.
Which is like 3 days ahead. So yeah. Monday for the Thursday game.
Yeah. So you see that and you're like, well, it doesn't say anything about the Tech game, so it's got to be about the Western program. So you click on it.
Or the whole thing is canceled. Well, they just only said one
game. But it would have said the other game is canceled, too. So you pull it up, and then it says it's been canceled due to concerns inside the Michigan program. Also, our game on December 29th against Michigan Tech will continue as planned. And you're just kind of looking at that like, well,
what am I missing?
So they've got the players to play the one game, but not the other game. And that doesn't make a lot of sense. So at this point, there's a lot of confusion about what's going on. And it's worth noting the sort of subtext for all of this, which we discussed on the last show, and I put in my final piece in December, which was no one in the Michigan sphere thought it was a good idea to have scheduled these games in the first place.
Right. I mean, they've been playing the GLI since before I was born, and Michigan has won many a GLI in those times. I guess it's harder now because all of their players are gone. I mean, they've lost players to the GLI before, or to the WJC before. It's not news, right?
But I think the thing that we were arguing about was just the idea that this isn't even the GLI anymore.
Well, that's
not a tournament.
That's
and true. Also, it doesn't make any sense to play top teams during a time when you sort of know ahead of time you're not going to play. So there was already a kind of pervasive belief that this was a bad idea to play these games.
Sure. Minnesota's not playing anyone.
So with that context, immediately the sort of obvious response is sort of like, well, it sort of just seems like Michigan doesn't want to play Western Michigan. It also didn't help that the game that they canceled was the better of the two teams.
And a team that ran them over in one game,
yeah.
And the second game was close, but Portillo bailed them out a ton, and Michigan hit the post, I think, a few times, but I think they did not want to play them without their top six or seven forwards.
That's what you would think. So that sort of started the national uproar, and Michigan did a very poor job of getting out ahead of the public outcry.
They also didn't really comment a whole lot.
They didn't comment until several days later, which allowed all of the national college hockey media, College Hockey News wrote about it,
yeah.
As well as the entire Western program, which was just sobbing on Twitter.
why do they care?
About
I mean, I get why they care, but like...
So then Michigan finally speaks during the Tech game, which is when Al Randall on the broadcast gives the official statement. And then after the game is when we got some of the folks from the Daily to finally interview Mel. And what they've maintained is that there was a call between Michigan's doctors and that Triscott and Portillo were not practicing prior to the games, that Bordalo was in COVID protocol, Steve Holtz was out with the shoulder thing, and Beecher was still listed as questionable on the injury report. So
before the Tech game?
That's
Truscott didn't play in the Tech game,
I thought he did.
Did he?
But
okay.
Regardless, I guess there was a belief that they were maybe gonna be short some guys and to the point at which they might not have a full roster, you know, a full 18 players, and that playing twice in a row with 16 guys would be bad. I don't know what the official line was, but that's sort of what they said. Now, I, in thinking about it and looking back, have come definitely more to the belief that it was probably outside of Mel's hands, because a coach at that level is not going to sort of instill, like, a, you know, cowardice in the locker room, basically.
Okay. I mean, I not arguing with you. I'm wondering why administration is desperate not to play that.
That's the other thing, is that if you do have these concerns, it makes more sense to cancel both games. Right. Also, here's the other underlying point. In a past world, like say this is 2019, you wouldn't have had this out.
Well,
right? Like,
that's true.
They
Well, I don't know. I mean, Michigan didn't claim COVID.
Well, they didn't, but it was a lot harder to just outright cancel games before that. Now teams have been given an immense amount of leeway. So I think my point in all of this is that the NCAA should use this opportunity to do what they should have done a long time ago, which is get proper transparency about these things. I mean, the fact that you have the pro sports where we get to know everything about every player's injury, and then in college it's just shrouded in total haze, basically.
I mean, I don't disagree with you, but like that's not happening.
It's not happening. But to me, at the very least, the fans who had bought tickets for the games should be given a proper reason why they're canceled. Right? They should be allowed to know who is in protocol, when they're going to be out of protocol, how many players are available, and why it was canceled. I think they owe, at the very least, the paying fans that.
I think that's probably true, but I don't see Michigan or probably many other programs ever doing that. And that's not a hockey thing. That's a pretty much every sport thing. I mean, maybe, and it would be nice, and I'd probably even cheer a little bit for a school that did that, but they don't have to, so why would they?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just my experience of being around college sports for, you know, 15 or 20 years. So, I mean, I'm kind of over it at this point. It's like, okay, should they have done that? Probably not. Was it shady? Yeah, I'm not a fan of all that move and sort of all the fallout around it, but I don't know. Yeah, you're right. They should have just canceled both games if that's how they felt. There's almost no reason to play the one game unless, I don't know. You have stronger opinions on this. To me, it's just, okay, this is what they did. Not what I would do, but what am I going to do about it? Yeah.
In the long run, no one will remember.
You really think so?
Except for Western Michigan. They will remember, but
remember the GLI that was only halfsies?
The selection committee has to put Michigan and Western together somehow. Or find it. Unless both are one seeds, then just pair them on the same side of the bracket.
You don't want Michigan to play Western for the title? Oh my gosh. But most of the world wouldn't know. Like, the hockey world would be like, there's going to be a murder on the ice! And everyone else is like, there's a game?
Yeah, basically.
So, we probably should talk about the game that was played, since this is a hockey cast that has a tendency to sometimes discuss what Michigan does on the ice. Michigan plays Michigan Tech on that Wednesday before not playing on Thursday, I guess. And if you didn't watch it, you didn't miss much. Did you watch much of this?
I was watching it, but was only half watching.
My first note is some things have kind of happened, but not really. As there were not scoring chances aplenty. We won't go through all of it the way we go through normal games because of Michigan was missing all those people, and it was just sort of a silly scenario that probably should have all been handled differently. And to sum it up, no one scored a goal. Johnny Beecher had two breakaways, both on penalty kills, that you would have liked him to finish at least one of those. It would have won them the game, I think. They had a two-on-one late with Duke and Morgan, and Duke hit the outside of the post. That was in the third period. It was really like a just get to overtime kind of game, and then like late third and overtime were kind of bananas. Like, Beecher and Pasta had a 2-on-1. I mean, like, we don't really count odd man rushes in overtime because there's like three players on each team, so if one person is slightly out of position, you automatically have an odd man rush, so it kind of is outside the scope of what we're trying to accomplish here. But they got another chance like that, and then I thought Ethan Edwards had a pretty decent game. until overtime when he just threw the puck in the middle of the ice and basically gave Michigan Tech a breakaway, and Lambert kind of hooked him, kind of pulled him down from behind. Lambert was pretty mad. I remember that he was called for that, so maybe he didn't think he actually committed a penalty. But he gets a penalty shot, which is sort of a preview to what is going to be the shootout, potentially. And Eric Portillo comes up huge and makes a save, and you're like, wow, no one can score a goal in this game, despite there being three breakaways.
I mean, once it got to, I mean, the last 3 minutes of regulation, I was like, just push it to overtime. And then they got to overtime, and I was like, just push for a tie. Like, if you can't get the goal, just...
Well, it
didn't. You're down a bunch of players. You're playing a pretty solid team. Like, a tie's fine. So, that save was big, because it preserved the tie.
I wonder what would have happened had they lost that in terms of pairwise, because they tied and dropped from, like, 1 or 2 to 6th.
Well, because a lot of teams at that time were piled up in our
PI. All right.
What I will say is that I loved them giving out the penalty shot in overtime.
Sure.
I am a big proponent of penalty shots in field. They are not given out nearly as much, and to do it in overtime takes a lot of guts, so that rocks. Do it more.
I mean, he was probably deserving of it. Now, I don't know if Lambert is correct.
Referees are so cowardly, though. I mean, they do not give out penalty shots when they should.
Yeah, because what's the conversion rate on penalty shots? Probably somewhere around 2-point conversion, slightly below 50.
Yeah.
And a power play, a good power play, is at like 1/4.
Yeah.
So you don't want to just get, I mean, because like it's sort of like giving away a PK in soccer, right? Like, if you call a guy for a penalty and he gets a penalty kick, like, it's probably a goal. Like, you could, not every single time, but almost every single time. And, like, the jump from 25% to high 40s or 50 is a significant jump. And in a game like that, you're going to decide it on that. So I see why someone would be hesitant to just award someone one of those chances. However, if the situation warrants that, you can't just say, oh, well, they would have won if I called it, so I'm not going to. Like, I mean, remember the Rams and Saints pass interference?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, you can't
The thing is that there's 2 degrees of penalties, right? It's not between not penalizing and penalizing, because you can just give out the 2-minute tripping minor, as opposed to the penalty shot, which is what so many refs do.
Sure, except in this game, if you'd watched any of the power plays, you were kind of like, well... I mean, Michigan had better chances on when they were down a man, because Johnny Beecher got 2 breakaways, than when they were at even strength. So, I don't know. And then there was no shootout, which...
The fans
Yost
were
was
not
very
happy about.
Upset
yeah.
about that, despite it really not mattering, because I don't believe pairwise would have taken that into consideration.
No, it would not have.
So you were just doing it for your own
fun.
Right. And that's the thing we've tried to take out of sports so much, is the fun. So that has been done for this game. I mean, I was happy because I was there longer than I wanted to be, and I was like, this game is, what am I going to say about this game anyway? And if then it goes to a shootout.
Hey, like, what you can say is this was a more enjoyable game than the last game against Tech in the GLI. So
that one I can't say I remember off the top of my head. It was like 3 years ago.
It was 2 years ago, but yes.
Okay.
Michigan was up, I think, 2-1 after 2, and then lost in the third period of the championship game.
That would be, yeah.
By the way, it's amazing how Tech always has a Pietola on their team.
Well, there's not, like, a lot of people that live in the UP,
they
right? And the ones that do probably play hockey.
They are, like, the hockey Plumleys. There's just one forever.
The Glasgows?
Or the Glasgows, yes. Except I think it's, like, extended family, like, not just brothers, but, like, there's cousins and stuff that have gone to Tech under that surname.
Do you think it's, like, planned out? Like, you map out, all right, this guy's
going
to be in college.
One last note on Tech before we go to the break. Right. But I don't understand why they're so salty about Mel leaving. Like, Yes. He resurrected their program, and they are...
Well, he went to Tech, didn't he?
Yes. They are still relevant because of, like, the lineage. Like... He, to them, is like Peterson at Boise State in football. Like, even after he's left, like, they've continued to just win. And...
Well, Boise State was a thing before Peterson, too.
Yeah, he took him to the next level, though. I mean,
Yeah.
Let's think of another one.
You got to have me give me time to prep for this stuff. You can't just, like, spring this.
The point is that, you know, they had not made the tournament in decades, had not been relevant in decades.
They had slipped away.
And then Mel takes over and gets them back to relevance. They continue to be relevant even after he's left. And I'm sorry, but when Michigan came calling, there was a 0% chance he was going to stay.
So wasn't there a thing, you probably weren't as into college hockey this long ago, but I thought I remember hearing from different people that Red told Mel to leave to go get some head coaching experience so that when he stepped down, he would just basically give him the job. Or something along those lines. Like, I don't know that it was that blatant, but it was more implied, or there was, like, rumors of that happening. And so that's why when there was the coaching search after Red retired, it was, like, everyone was just like, it's just Mel, it's Mel. And I think Adam and I did a piece on, like, trying to research anyone else that you could possibly hire to be like, okay, I'm not saying that that Michigan can hire Mel, but it's not like there is one coaching opportunity out there, or coaching candidate out there. There are other options. Anyway, so that it seemed to me like, well, this is why he left. Because he was at Michigan for like 20-something years. Like, you don't just like randomly leave.
He left because Michigan came calling and he was coaching.
No. You don't leave Michigan to go be a head coach after you've been assistant coach for like 20 years. Unless you're planning to prep to take the next
step. Well, I mean, anyone wants to go and, you know, be a head coach, right, and move up to the next level, so...
Well, you would think that, but not if you don't do anything for literally two decades.
Yeah, I mean, my point is just, you had a successful head coach, he did a lot of good for your program, and also your Michigan Tech. Like, I'm sorry, you just can't cry when someone leaves to go to a blue blood. Like,
Do you think that they view themselves as a blue blood, though? I mean, they probably do.
Well, in that case, they're Texas A&M thinking they're a historic college football program.
Ooh, that's an interesting comparison. I think they recruit a little better than Texas, or A&M probably recruits a little better than Michigan Tech does in hockey.
Yeah, well, they're also not in Houghton, Michigan. So.
But they have all the Pietolas. Should we take a break and come back and just have a really long segment of talking about a lot of UMass games?
Yes.
If you find yourself in the penalty box in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man arguing your case. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458 or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
Before Saturday, how many times had Michigan and UMass played in hockey, ever?
Goose egg.
Correct. Is that kind of surprising?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's only 59...
Well, and they're also two of the oldest programs.
Right, but there's only 59, and two of those 59 college hockey teams, like, just came into existence in the last 2 years. At some point, like, you will have played everyone. Right? Like, you just schedule, oh, okay, well, we need a team. Well, I'll go get them. All right. Well, we'll play them. Or you'll run into them in the tournament. Although, UMass until, what, Cale Makar was not so great, right? I mean, they were more bottom end of Hockey East.
Yeah, and they were not, like, an elite program.
Right. And then in the last, what, 4 years, I would say, they've become, well, they're the defending national champions, so that's maybe underselling it a bit. The first point that I had is I've forgotten about Cal Kifuk and how there were whispers of him coming to Michigan and
he didn't sign, but he was a
commit. He was going to come, yeah. And Michigan deferred him.
With the way Mel has recruited, there's a lot of guys out there we see on other teams who were once Michigan commits and then got shoved to the side for someone better.
But he's a junior,
like,
which
that's
is...
a chunk of Ohio State's team between Guzzo and the other guy on defense, McWard.
Well, and Westland, right?
I don't remember that one, right. But...
Kifuk is a junior, though, so he would have been a year before those, like, the two monster classes. And so he's always sort of one of the what-if guys. I mean, I didn't really notice him a whole lot in the game. I mean, he played the puck, I think, a few times, probably. He was on the ice. But it's just one of those things that you think about when you're like, oh, well, we could have gotten him, like when you watch any college football game. You're like, oh, yeah, Michigan recruited him. Oh, yeah, I wish we had him.
Yeah, Lewis seen in the Georgia game last night.
Like, what is, like, 2 years ago, half of Alabama's roster was like, oh, they almost had
Najee Harris in the Citrus Bowl.
Najee Harris. Oh, they almost had. But then you're like, oh, we were never getting him anyway, yeah. So.
We're Michigan Tech, so.
I think the funniest thing that happened in this game was, it was like a minute or two into the game, and KJ hits Brisson wide open in the slot, and he goes bar down and scores a goal after, you know, you have 60 minutes of... Oh, here is a decent chance. Will the guy either get the shot off or hit the net with anything? And then Brisson, like, buries a really nice pass and a perfect shot. And you're like, hey, it's really nice to have this talent back after not for the previous few games.
Well, I would like to first say that I did not see much of this game at all because, for those who follow me on Twitter, I am back in Southeast Michigan. I had been in Toronto a few days ago and then spent 6 hours loading up a U-Haul with furniture and other
things. So you didn't have to go to the gym then?
And so then I drove that back Friday night. So then Saturday, while the game was going on, I was unloading the U-Haul.
I see.
Up a flight of stairs.
Again, so you got to skip the gym day.
Yeah, exactly. So I was wrangling a couch instead of watching this game.
Did you get, like... the lasso out?
It was,
like,
me, you know, if you ever watched the Thanksgiving peanut special where Snoopy fights the ping pong table, that was me on the couch.
Well, there's an image for you. So they get this goal, and then right afterwards, Van Wy almost hits a stop at backdoor, but it somehow didn't go in, and I never got a clear view of why it didn't, but it was a tap-in, and you were like, whoa, this is two great chances right away that, like, obviously the game wouldn't be over because, you know, UMass has talent and everything, but you're like, all of a sudden Michigan's offense is to life, and away we go, but he didn't get it in. They pretty much have a really dominant first few minutes and get another couple chances. Murray makes a save or two. And it's like, hey, here's this team again. Like, this is the team that we were supposed to have all year, and they're back, but they just can't get a second goal. And then you have a breakdown in Michigan's end where they turn the puck over behind the net, and I believe Hughes was out of position. So we should mention that Truscott didn't play in this game, which sort of shifted Michigan's pairings, because Truscott usually plays with Hughes as his sort of defensive babysitter, and Blankenberg plays with Power. Well, with Truscott out, they eventually moved. They tried to play Holtz, right? I mean, because he came back for like a period and...
re-aggravated his injury.
Is that what it was?
Yes.
He re-aggravated, okay.
And will be out a longer period of time. Weather report yesterday.
So then they moved Blankenberg down with Hughes and had Keaton Pearson up with Power, which they'd tried before early in the year. And Hughes was, I didn't see where he was on the ice. Blankenberg had sort of tied his guy up and they got a guy to get the puck behind the net. I think it was Waite and, or Lupina, I'm sorry. And then he hit Trevigno in front, who Blankenberg sort of had tied up, but didn't, and was still able to poke the puck past Portillo. I didn't really put that on Portillo at all. Blankenberg was there, so I'm not going to say that, you know, he wasn't in the right spot, but he did not tie up his guy. And all of a sudden, it's 1-1 after a pretty dominant period by Michigan. I think they end up taking a penalty at the end of that period, too. Yeah, it was. So they end up taking another penalty. And this is breakaway number 3 for Johnny Beecher on the penalty kill in alone, and he is stoned. And Portillo ended up having to make a save, and that was pretty much it for that power play. So at the end of one, it's 1-1 after Michigan could have had, probably had three goals in that period easily. They come out of it 1-1. It was almost deja vu then again, because they played this really great period and still somehow don't have a lead.
There were people on the internet talking about, like, oh, wow, what poor luck for Johnny Beecher. Stoned on the breakaway again on the penalty kill. And I kind of tweeted about that, and I was sort of like, you know, at some point, it's just kind of who you are. Like,
yeah.
It depends on the context, right, of who the guy is that we're talking about. Like, if it's like, oh, wow, five straight breakaway attempts, like, you know, foiled for Austin Matthews or Alexander Ovechkin or someone like that.
TJ Oshie.
Then you're like, yeah, that's probably bad luck.
Yeah.
But, like, we've talked about this. And Luke Morgan's another one at Michigan's level, and you can find endless number of these guys in the NHL, whether it's Darren Helm or Ilya Mikheyev or blah, blah, blah. It's like, we know this about Beecher. He's got the speed. He's got the size. He creates some rush chances for himself, and questions about his ability to finish those have followed him his whole career. And I don't really think it's, like, bad luck. This is just kind of who you are. And hopefully he'll convert one at some point.
Well, I think the frustrating thing about Beecher a little bit is, like, we'd hope that he would be a little bit better in five-on-five situations and potentially carrying his own line. Maybe we thought at times with, like, a Duke and a Samuskevich or something. It's just they've shuffled some guys around with him. They've put him on different lines. They've put other guys with him. It's nothing has really worked 5-on-5, and so he's gotten, but his speed has created, and size have created these chances for him, and this is a way for him sort of to contribute, and he just hasn't been able to finish them. I remember after the second one against Michigan Tech, he's like skating back to the bench, and he just takes his stick, and he just whacks against the boards, not the lower boards, like the upper, like, plexiglass board. So it's really loud, and it's very obvious because he's not trying to hide it, and you can see he's frustrated, and I completely get it. It's just that if that's who you are, like, you've got to figure out a way to improve that part of your game, because that's how you can contribute, at least to this team, if not going forward in your career. But anyway, into the second period, Beniers and Blankenberg had a really nice chance down the slot. It was a one-timer that Beniers shifted over to Blankenberg on a save. That's going to be a theme of the rest of this podcast is, oh, Matt Murray makes a really good save. Not that Matt Murray, by the way. He did not get demoted from Ottawa.
I mean, this might be more his level of competition.
Ooh, spicy. UMass gets another power play right after this. And because Samuskevich played the puck going on a change, it was kind of an interesting play. He's skating to the bench, and someone just, like, passes him the puck, and you can see someone jumping off the bench. And I guess he could jump and, like, jump over it, but maybe that's more on the passer. Again, this is the second penalty kill in a row. Johnny Beecher gets loose again, gets in, and this, I believe, was a blocker save. The first one, I think, he tried to go five hole and was stopped. This one was a blocker save that went wide. Portillo, I think, had to make one more save, but that was pretty much it. And I thought that Michigan's penalty kill was pretty good for the most part. They had one penalty or power play that they had to shut down that Portillo was really good on, but for the most part, the PK, I think, was pretty solid, even all weekend. I mean, spoiler alert in the game too, but special teams were fine, at least the protective side for Michigan. Yeah, you agree?
I agree in spirit.
I have a couple other things that happened, but nothing was really that exciting. Michigan did sort of turn up the heat throughout the second period. Hughes had a nice play of just sort of, you could see his skating and just missed the finishing pass. They had a 2-on-1 with KJ and Brisson, and KJ hit the post. They got a power play, and Samo missed a tic-tac-toe from the slot. It was really well set up, but they couldn't get anything else. And I wrote about this, I think, in one of the... I can't remember which game, because both games are kind of the same. But you still saw the Jekyll and Hyde aspects to Michigan's power play where, you know, they can look really good and create these chances, and then they cannot get the puck in the zone for the next 90 seconds. And I'm not sure if that's like a lot of player juggling because they've had guys in and out of the lineup due to these extreme circumstances, and or if they're trying to find the right spots. I mean, they kind of have too many guys for a power play. Like, we talked about this. Will they overload one and put all their stars on one, or will they try to balance it out and mix in a couple other pieces and have two sort of equal power plays? And they've never really settled on anything in one particular direction or the other. And it's still good. It's just up and down.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of feeling that the power play should be better than it is, right now at least.
Like from a structural standpoint almost?
Just in terms of results, but their process, at least when I saw it on Sunday, looked fine. It was more bad luck that they didn't get a power play goal through a lot of that game.
Yeah, I would agree with that, especially their second or third one. One of those was just like, Murray just made like five saves, and you're like, well, all right. Into the third, still 1-1, and this is a game where you're like, again, I think Michigan's the better team. Their speed is on display. UMass couldn't really skate with them, but Matt Murray is just keeping them in the game. They had a chance back door, Brisson to Beniers. And this is the other thing we should try to talk about a little bit, too, is so Michigan switched up their forwards by overloading one line because you had KJ and Beniers, who've been skating together for most of the year, and without Bortolo, they decided to pair Brisson with them, and that was a line that UMass could not handle at all.
Yeah, I mean, this gets more in the second game, because I thought they were just incredible in that second game, but that line is definitely the biggest development to talk about this weekend.
Yeah. Duke had a chance backdoor, but Lambert had missed him. This was, again, starting the third, so they have a couple opportunities with Brisson, Beniers, and Kent Johnson, and then the Lambert line with Duke had a good chance. Couldn't get it done, but as the third period draws on, Michigan is just too much, and it is the top line again. There's a bad turnover by UMass trying to exit the zone, and Brisson gets the puck, gets all the way to the goal line, holds it, and then has a nice saucer pass over to KJ on the opposite side for a dunk, and it's 2-1 Michigan, and at that point you're like, I'm not seeing how UMass is going to tie this. It's going to be something sort of fluky-ish, but I didn't really see them getting a really great chance. They lead 2-1, are pretty much in control. They start maybe doing bit of fancy stuff. That's the one thing that I feel like when you put all those guys on that line, it might come out a little bit more, is like Brisson did the reach between his legs thing again. KJ got a little fancy when they had a 3-on-1 after a defensive zone turnover. And then finally, late in the game, there is a really bad pass to exit the zone. Johnson picks it off around the red line, hits Beniers and Brisson. They go back and forth a couple of times, and Brisson finishes it, makes it 3-1. They had an empty netter, but that was pretty much the game. And it was the top line, again, that brought Michigan to the finish line.
Those guys are pretty good.
They also, did you see the challenge? So Michigan challenged a hit on Owen Power on the boards. I thought maybe it could have been a call. I also was not expecting Michigan to win because they don't really win challenges.
So that review was going on right as I got back and turned on the television.
Did you see?
I saw it and I was like, that looks pretty bad.
Yeah.
But I didn't get to really see the play live or anything. And then they were like, nope, 2-minute minor.
Yeah. Well, did they even call a penalty on that?
I don't know. Actually, maybe
no, I don't think they called a penalty because Mel wanted to challenge if it was a... Because you can only challenge if it's a major, right? Like,
yes.
You can take it from nothing to a major, but you can't award a penalty, I guess.
If one wasn't already awarded.
Right. They didn't win it. It was also 2-1 at the time, and they were in control, so I wasn't surprised. So Michigan wins the first game, and they do it in convincing fashion, and it probably could have been more than 4-1. I mean, obviously one goal is the empty netter, a Beecher semi-breakaway, ironically. But Matt Murray was just really, really good. And I was trying to figure out, like, how UMass won the title last year. I guess they lost some guys.
They lost some guys.
They did lose some guys. But Matt Murray was there, yes? And I assume that he was a huge part of that.
I mean, they had Zach Jones, who was one of the better defensemen in all of college hockey last year, and now he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Top prospect in the Rangers. I don't remember who their other top players were. Let me look it up. But I mean,
you could see where...
I mean, this is a good team. Like, let's be really clear about this. Like, even this year, they were one record coming into this weekend. I mean...
Yeah, they were like 10-4-2 or something like that.
And, like, they'd only really been hammered by one team, and that was Minnesota State. So...
I believe they're second in Hockey East, although Hockey East is a little jumbled
Eastern
this year.
The Eastern conferences are very weak this year.
Yeah.
So, their scoring last year, I mean, Trevino, 34 points in 29 games. Oliver Chow, 27 points in 29 games. Zach Jones was fourth. Matthew Kessel, Lapina. I mean, not a lot of big names here.
I think three of those guys are still there.
Lindbergh and Murray were their two goalies last year. It was a tandem, and they split time pretty much evenly. But Lindbergh was better. Jeez, 949 save percentage.
That'll do it.
Both guys had sub-2 goals against. So basically, they suffocated teams.
Yeah, I mean, they were a good defensive team, I think.
Yes.
And you could see that that's what they were trying to do.
I mean, they allowed 3 goals in the tournament total. 5-1, 4-0, 3-2, 5-0.
It's really hard to lose when you don't give up goals.
Hey, they went to overtime with Duluth, but they were the ones that beat Duluth in the semifinals.
Well, it's about time. That's
they
all I can
the
say.
They were the team that finally found their own horseshoe or whatever.
Or just stole their Duluth. Hopefully not to give it back. Okay, so that's the first game. I was impressed. And then you get to the point of where, okay, I've seen Michigan do this in game one before, and then game two, they come out and are maybe not as focused, but that didn't really happen. Michigan started game two pretty good. They force Murray to make a save right away. I thought their defense was a little sloppier in the first period than later on. Portillo made a number of saves. He played pretty well. It didn't seem that UMass had like a lot of highly talented scoring forwards. And in fact, if you look at their statistics, I think two of their top three or four players in scoring are on their back on the blue line. So they like to get their D-men going, but they didn't have like we saw in the Minnesota series, you saw Matthew Nyes, right? And he makes plays happen in the offensive zone. And it didn't seem like they had a player of that level. And so they more needed like their systems to create goals. And that was something that I don't think that they did a great job of. They had a couple of chances off of Michigan breakdowns, but they didn't have a guy that could sort of bury that puck.
Well, it also hurt that their defense kind of have to create stuff for them, and yet their defensemen just were awful at trying to get out of the zone. I mean, how many Michigan's goals this weekend were that sort of thing?
Well, we talked about a couple of them from the first game alone.
Yes. Zone exits, boom, turnover at the blue line, and it's a quick goal.
And then... Like, again, so this is the thing. We were excited about that top line, and you said that development was big. I thought, again, it just got a little fancy, and, like, KJ got the puck in the slot and had, like, this backwards pass looking for Brisson on the back door, and he's, like, in the slot. And that's a situation where, like, just shoot the puck.
Look, they're susceptible to trying to be the Red Army and do a bunch of, you know, cute stuff where there's 5 guys rotating and, you know, they're all Pavel Datsyuk brain and they all know where everyone else on the ice is, even though they really don't. But at the end of the day, this line, when it was out there in both games, were slanting the ice in their direction.
Yeah.
Whole time. And, you know, this group of players, I mean, they've been kind of doing, you know, we talked about this earlier in the year, right? You had this Borlo-Brisson, like, marriage, and then Johnson and Beniers' marriage, and those are your two lines, and that's kind of the way it is. Well, now Bordeleau's out of the picture for undisclosed reasons, and so they decide to kind of do the overload thing, and like you see this a lot in NHL teams. Like a lot of teams, they have the 2 big stars or the 3 or 4 big stars, and I mean, some teams don't do it right. Some teams do it this way, like the Bruins do. All the guys are just going to be together. And the Avalanche do that too. But a lot of other teams, like, we're going to put Malkin and Crosby on two different lines. Or we have the Matthews-Marner pair and the Nylander-Tavares pair. And then every so often you would see this in games where, like, oh, it's Zetterberg and Datsyuk, two different lines. But now we need offense, so they're going to play together.
Yeah.
And Michigan's kind of doing that. We have two pairs. Well, now we're going to put them all together and just create one turbocharged line. And, I mean, at the end of the day, they were playing a good team, and they scored 5 goals on the weekend. And so, from a sort of playing style standpoint, it also makes a lot of sense because they do complement each other. You have the goal, I think it was the first goal, or maybe I don't remember which goal it was, the one on Sunday where it's off a dump-in, where Beniers goes in, retrieves it, throws it to the front, and I think it got redirected right to, I think, was it Johnson, and then he fired it in. But the point there is you see that's how it works. So you have Beniers as the retriever who's going to work below the goal line. You have Johnson as the passer, and Brisson as the shooter. And that really works, right? Like, yeah. That's almost like, you know, that's sort of how you're going to do it on this line, basically.
So they create a bunch of chances in this period, and then what you just described, it was the first goal at the end of the first period, where Brisson scored. It looked like it was more of a loose puck, and there was like a lot going on in front of the net, but he got an open look.
But it happens because you have Beniers as your retriever.
Right, right. And he scored up high, and it was 1-0, and you were off and running again. And then as the second period starts, you kind of have something similar where Brisson goes flying down the slot, dishes it over Beniers, and he has a snipe. And it's 2-0, and this line is just absolutely blistering. And, you know, it'll be interesting if they have to stay together like that when you play teams that have more lines. But I just think that they sort of overran Massachusetts in this series and got pretty good solid defense in the back. You didn't have I don't think Michigan gave up an odd man rush at all.
Well, the one thing I want to point out is you talked to me about, oh, Michigan needs more scoring from the bottom three lines.
It would be nice at times.
And I think that's where the Bortolo comes into play, who apparently is now done with whatever was being done to him, why he couldn't play last weekend. But
he's supposed to play this weekend?
Yes, he's cleared. That's what Mel said in the presser yesterday.
He was at the games in, like, speaking of fedoras, he was sitting in, like, the players area in this, like, jungle hat fedora thing, like,
maybe he was, like, was he dressed like trench coat guy?
I don't think he had a trench coat on, but he definitely had, you knew it was him because it was a very fancy hat.
Well, you could also tell it was him because he's got bad hair. And
he just kind of is always, like, goofy and laughing and smiling. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, and his whole left arm is tatted up, but...
Well, it wasn't bare, but...
Okay, yeah. That's why he was wearing a trench coat.
There
and
you
to
go.
Disguise it. Anyway...
Cover your tats, I guess.
The point is, when you get Bortolo back, I mean, I would go with, like, him... Samoskevich, and then I don't know, Mike Pasta, something like that.
For the second,
like, I'm a big fan of you know, Samo and the way he's come on, and then you have Bortolo there, and you can put whoever with that, and I think that's a fine second line, and it allows you to keep that first line together. So you have, like, this is our one, like, it's basically like that's going to be our Avalanche thing, right? Like, we're going to have our big number one, and then our second line is going to be the, like, Kadri and whoever else, Nichushkin
and Burakovsky.
Right? Like, that's going to be our second line, which, like, is all you need if your first line is, like, undisputably the best in the league.
Right.
So I would be fine with that. You just need Bortolo back to get there.
And Samo has a lot of similarities to Brisson in that they can both shoot and skate.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. It's 2-0 at this point, and this is where I think that power play for UMass comes into play, where Portillo steps up really big. He had a nice first period. I thought he played well in the second again, especially on that power play. I think he had 3 or 4 saves hit on him by himself. The penalty kill could not get the puck clear, but he did his job keeping the puck out of the net. You know, he's not going to have the numbers because they hang him out to dry from time to time, or, you know, they let up a little bit when they get up. But he's been as good a goalie. I mean, like, Mann was really, really good. I remember we had this discussion and everything. But Portillo's been awesome this year. Has he not?
I'm a big fan of Portillo. I mean, he, in the three games we're talking about, gave up three total goals in 185 minutes.
I mean,
and two of which came after the game was sealed. So
right.
He's been really good for the last, and this whole season, but even right now, this is one of his best stretches.
Like, he had that goofy game against Notre Dame where he, like, turned the puck over behind the net, and he gave away a goal and gave up a soft goal, and I was like, that's, like, the only game I feel like I can think of looking back where I was like, all right, probably should have done better there. But the rest of the games, you're like,
Every goalie has those games.
Right, but 1 in 23 is like, sign me up for that.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, we probably haven't talked about Murray enough, because I thought he, I mean, half of my notes are really good chance Murray save, or, you know, Murray keeping them in it. I mean, they had that awesome power play that you had referenced. It was in the second period because it was right in front of me, and Michigan probably could have had 3 or 4 goals on it, and he made, like, lunging saves, not like where, you know, Portillo has a tendency to just be large and take stuff away. He makes good saves with his pads and his glove, but Murray was, like, flying around almost Hasek style, like, from one side to the other, off balance, just getting part of his body out, getting his glove in the right spot, and it was basically what kept Michigan from not having 8 goals on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, I had nothing but good things to say about Murray.
So it's 2-0, and then late in the game, you get the really nice play. What you're really hoping for from a different line, like we were talking about, like, Morgan and Lambert have been good. They just, neither one can really finish. And so they can create at times. I think they're in good position a lot of times. They can both skate, so you get into the zone. They don't really have a great shot or can pick corners, and so you just end up with pucks in goalies' chests. And this is the play that was really nice from Dylan Duke. I wrote about this, on Sunday, where he does a good job keeping the puck in the zone and gets it off to a teammate and immediately goes to the net. And Blankenberg hits him on a great diagonal and gets a good shot. And, of course, Murray makes a save because that's what happened all weekend. But Duke stays with it and puts the rebound in, this time going high because Murray had to come across, so he's down on the ice. First shot save, second shot's lifted, goes up into the net, and it's 3-0. And that's pretty much the game, but that's the kind of stuff that, like, Michigan doesn't have a lot of those kinds of players where you get to the front of and get the puck in. You have, obviously, that top line, and we've talked about those guys, and they can do almost everything, but once you get past that, Duke has been pretty good in front of the net, and they've put him there on the power play from time to time. He's scored a few goals there throughout the year. It's not like he's, you know, filling up the net every game, but this was a nice addition to this team, and I think if you can get him down in those situations, that's a nice threat from what would be, I guess, the third line.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to put Duke with Bortolo and Sambo, I wouldn't.
Well, like we said, we talked about that with Beecher, and maybe Bortolo's the center for them?
Yeah, I mean, you could put Duke on the second or the third line. He has a role to play.
And I think, you know, early on in the season, you saw something he did nice every once in a while. Now you're seeing sort of those intervals get shorter, where you're like, oh, those are some nice plays from Duke, and then there's a break, and then, oh, there's Duke again, and then it's getting shorter and shorter, and that's sort of what you want to see from your freshmen is, you know, yeah, it's nice when they do something all-world or whatever, but if you can get them to contribute and do little things more and more and more, sort of like Ethan Edwards. I think he's become really good. You've been high on him all year. Obviously, he's had his mishaps, but he's a freshman. It's sort of a similar track, I think.
Yeah.
In the third period, it was basically just Michigan screwing around for most of the game, or for most of the period until late when it got weird. But you had Portillo basically sitting back there. KJ tried the Mike leg, which you are a huge fan of. You want to see more people do this, yes?
It has jumped the shark. Sad to say, but everyone's doing it now, and it's not as impressive anymore.
There was some play where Power just skated the blue line for what seemed like a minute, and he's just going back and forth. UMass has packed in around their goalie. It's 3-0. He has nowhere to go. He has nowhere to shoot, so he just is sort of skating back and forth. They can't really catch him. They don't really can't take the puck or anything. He's not really giving it up, and it's just sort of this, like, is it like Pong where the, like, the thing goes back and forth and you're just, like, trying to time it and get the shot? Yes. That's what it seemed like with Power just, like, going back and forth on the blue line. Murray makes more saves, and you're just like, okay, well, this guy's really, really good. Finally, Michigan gets a power play. It's, I think it was about five or six minutes left. And right off the draw, like, Hughes is turning around and skating. The puck comes back, and he gets beaten by Bobby Trevino. And Trevino snipes one from Portillo. I think it was far post, from a bit of a distance. And all of a sudden, it's like 3-1. I didn't really put that on Portillo. I didn't see the generation of that as to, like, did Hughes mishandle that, did you see? Or was it just sort of like a draw that they both raced for?
No, Hughes kind of fumbled it at the line.
Okay. Which we've also seen.
And then
happen.
He was coming from a strange angle when it was time to try and win the foot race.
So it's a shorthanded goal. It was a bummer for Portillo not to get a shutout. But, you know, that stuff tends to happen randomly at times, especially when you're up 3-0. I really thought Michigan played really, really, really well, other than, like, that one sequence in the third period. And it was also weird because UMass wasn't really pressing down 3 goals.
I mean, sometimes it's hard to tell when a team is pressing if it's just not getting anywhere.
Well, and then they give up another goal that was, what, like, right at the very end, like, a minute ago?
Well, after they got the empty
net. After they get an empty net. That Beecher scores from, like...
Yeah, he is the new Mark Scheifele.
70 feet away.
Just the empty net assassin.
And then the second shot, I think, is... Or the second goal for UMass was, like, a pretty much a snipe. Like, he just picked a corner, threw some traffic. Not a lot Portillo can do.
With, like, 30 seconds left.
The only thing that it does is it sort of, like, eats away at your narrative where you're like, oh, this is actually really well. They play good defense, and in the end it ends up being 4-2. And you're like, oh, it's a close game. But when you look at all of, like...
I mean, if you look at the even strength Corsi, it was, like, 60-65% in both games. So,
yeah.
End of story.
Right. So, I was not expecting a sweep, were you?
I wasn't really thinking about anything before these games, so...
So you were not, either. a really good weekend for Michigan. I think they're clearly better than UMass. I actually like the matchup, if they play them again.
Well, yeah, it was a friendly matchup because UMass is, you know, they're playing a similar-ish style to Michigan. They want their defense activated, and they want to play a little more open. I mean, they're not out there trying to beat you up or park the bus or anything. So I think that we're going to do the same thing as you, except you have better players.
Yeah.
Not, you know, that plays into Michigan's hands. Just like this upcoming weekend.
That'll be interesting. We'll get to that in a second. First, we should go through the Big Ten because some things have happened. Several of note. First, Michigan State played Minnesota. You're hoping for some, not counting on a lot of help there. They kind of get run, I think, in the first game. Then have a 3-1 lead in the second game, and you're thinking maybe they can take a point off of Minnesota. No.
If you saw the box scores, they were basically the same as that infamous tournament game.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Michigan State's maybe better over last year. I haven't seen a lot of them, and, you know, the pairwise likes them, but pairwise likes the Big Ten in general, so whatever. But, I mean, I'm sorry. Any of the Spartans fans listening to this, like, I just can't take Michigan State seriously as a hockey program until they're, like, not getting caved in by Minnesota. Like, when you're getting outshot 40-10 by, like, a good team in the conference, you're just not a contender. Like, I'm sorry, you're just not even close. You cannot try and win consistently like that.
Do you think there are Spartan fans listening to this?
I don't know, but that's the thing that they have to change. Like, you just cannot win that way. You can win trying to park the bus. You cannot win trying to do that.
Play, like, 5 goalies.
We shoot 5 times, and if we go up 1-0, we will not attempt a shot on goal for the
rest of the game. No one's allowed past the red line.
Like, that's just not how it works.
So, slightly a bummer for Michigan fans hoping to Minnesota drops any points. They don't. But they dropped a player. Kind of.
So someone who commented on my column today, put a pretty good column, or a pretty good comment,
Okay.
And it was like, I'm trying to which formatting it was. Like, it was tired, wired, inspired. But it was like, tired, losing your players to the WJC. Wired, losing your players to the Olympics. Inspired, losing your goalie to the NHL in the middle of the season.
I mean, that's not unprecedented. People have left in the middle of the season before.
Not very often.
No, it's not often. It also generally doesn't come off a team that has a chance to win a title.
Yeah, it's not a common thing, just even in general.
So Jack LaFontaine, who played at Michigan back in, like, 2008, it feels like, which, that's not true, it was, like, 2018, 2017. Decides that after this weekend, that he's gonna go sign with the Hurricanes.
I thought you already signed.
Oh, he signed before the weekend?
No, on Sunday afternoon.
Well, that's what I mean. After,
yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
After the games,
yeah.
Says, I've had enough of college, I've been here
well,
for
it's
like
more,
6 years.
So they came in and they offered him not just an ELC, but it had performance incentives, and it speeds up the timeline that he becomes a free agent, is my understanding.
But he's already like 25.
It was basically the like the offer you can't refuse type deal, because the Hurricanes need a goalie. I'm not sure what exactly is going on in Charlotte, where their affiliate is, but the AHL goalies are, like, all injured, and, like, they're going to have to bring David Ayers back off the Zamboni in case if someone gets injured, so...
Who's going to take his spot?
So they needed a goalie, and LaFontaine is in their system, and is, I mean, he's as NHL ready as he'll, or, you know, minor league ready as he'll ever be, and it's a good deal for him because it was a sweetened deal, and, like, I imagine, and I mean, J.D. Burke tweeted this, and he's an NHL internet scout, like, they are very cognizant, the scouting community is, that, like, he's been kind of bad this year, especially relative to last season.
Yeah.
And so, cashing in before you possibly put up two more months of, like, 900 save percentage is probably a good idea.
So that leaves Minnesota with Justin Close?
Yes, who has 28 minutes played this season.
And I believe 26 were against Michigan?
Yes, after LaFontaine had been chased.
In the game that no one watched because it was on during the Big Ten Championship.
Yes.
So it may or may not have actually happened.
He's been in the program for 3 years, so... You know, he's Trenty Jones or something like that. It's not a fresh face. He's been around.
Yeah.
But he is...
Unproven.
Very unproven. He has, I think, 6 career appearances over those 3 seasons. So...
Well, now if they play Minnesota it in net, it's definitely advantage Michigan.
Yes, if it wasn't already, but...
Good point.
That's definitely an interesting development, especially because Minnesota is the other team besides Michigan who stands to really get hit by the Olympics.
Which, you want to talk about that now or in a few minutes?
No, we should talk about that now.
Okay.
Unless there's anything else. I mean, Ohio State took 5 of 6 from Wisconsin.
And so did Notre Dame took 5 of 6 from Penn State. We'll just run through the Penn State stuff quickly. Because we play them this weekend at Yost after sweeping them in Hockey Valley.
Which
and
were not really competitive games.
I believe they were very similar games, right? I mean, Michigan in the end pulls away by a few goals. So Penn State is still 23rd in pairwise, but you think this is because the pairwise loves...
Well, so Penn State is kind of like Funhouse Mirror Michigan, where...
There's a reference.
Like a similar team, but not similar in that they're not nearly as good, but they're similar in that... Both teams have played their best hockey outside the league. So Penn State is definitely not the worst team in the conference, but they're the worst team in the standings because they just keep getting pounded by the Big Ten, and Wisconsin somehow keeps getting like a point each weekend while Penn State's getting swept in regulation. And as a result, Wisconsin is not in the cellar, even though Wisconsin's a vastly worse team. But in the non-con, Penn State's like 10-1 with a win over North Dakota, which is really... bolstering their pairwise.
In, like, Nashville, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, they've played better outside the conference than in the conference. And, I mean, they are probably the best matchup for Michigan in the entire conference.
They're kind of like a worse version of UMass.
Well, if they're kind of like, we're going to outscore you, Michigan, with our 26-year-olds.
Probably not. They are fourth in Corsi, but that's probably has something to do with...
Been, yeah.
Yeah, but also has to do with the, like, the... shot counters.
The shot counter, and they just shoot all the
Pegula.
Time.
Yeah.
And
20% on the power play is okay.
Yeah, I mean, they can still score. They're 3.5 goals per game this season. The problem is, like, if you're sitting there and you're thinking, okay, how are you going to beat Michigan? You're going to need, number one, play a contrasting style.
Yeah.
Be like a Western who's going to impose their will or something like that.
Be large.
Minnesota State who's going to slow it down. And as part of that, you've got to have a good goalie. You just have to. And Penn State has two sub-900 saves.
So I think I took Audio's numbers because out of 20-something games, he
played
17.
He's the starter, but Soulier is worse.
And we saw Michigan saw him in
Michigan
the second
saw,
game.
Yeah, both guys. And neither guy are
they
good.
They look kind of the same.
So Penn State has none of the things you would expect.
No. And starting with their 75% penalty kill, which that seems like Michigan could hopefully get their power play back on track. They only
if Michigan loses these games, it's going to be repeats of the Wisconsin game, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, Thomas Bortolo just put it in his own net. And like, oh, Garrett Van Wy just got hit in the head, and the referee called a penalty on Garrett Van Wy.
For punching himself in the face.
Like, that is how it's going to happen.
Yeah.
There's just not really a path otherwise.
They only have three skaters that are over 0.75 points per game. They only have three drafted skaters, so there's not infinite talent there. They'd had more talent in the past. 2.89 GAA and an 8.99 save percentage. So I'm thinking that Michigan's probably going to score some goals this weekend.
Probably.
Hopefully.
I mean,
so we should just make a note in the standings really quick that Minnesota has now passed Michigan and are up by 2 points with all games.
Everyone's at 12 games right now.
Right. So Minnesota is, I believe, 2 points ahead of Michigan, which means they're at like 25. Michigan's at 23.
Yeah.
And then Ohio State and Notre Dame are both at 22.
If you're looking at the course of this season, you're just basically saying we should not have blown that first Notre Dame game, and we should have not choked against Wisconsin.
Right.
Flip those two things around, you're clear at 28 points, comfortably in first.
Right.
But you had four really bad periods. Five if you count the other Notre Dame game, but I'm just saying take one of those two.
Right.
So that's kind of where you're at, and it's a little bit of a bummer because I'm looking at these next six games, and I think you need to come very close to winning all six in regulation to stomach the 2 weeks of a lot of guys being gone.
Which we will talk about in just a second. So they play Penn State, which they're better than. They go to Minnesota, which is going to be interesting because there's no LaFontaine, but it's on the road, although Michigan has done pretty well there. And then you have a trip to Madison, which normally is like, but this year is maybe like,
Wisconsin's awful.
Right. So they have four games that they're going to be clearly better than the team they're playing. And if you get a split in Minneapolis, I mean, I would probably take 5 or 6.
I would take 5 or 6. I would love that sweep with Minnesota. I mean, I'm very much less concerned about Minnesota now, considering they're also going to go through the Olympics thing and they lost their goalie. I'm more concerned about Ohio State and Notre Dame now, because those are the teams that are going to have the window to make a run while Michigan and Minnesota are shorthanded.
So Ohio State does come to Yost during this winter break. Michigan will go to Notre Dame. Maybe, maybe not. Will they have their players or not?
So
let's talk about the Olympics. The NHL isn't going, and so now they're going to just basically take all of Michigan and Minnesota's players.
So the NHL decided not to go to the Olympics because they had carved out this break for the Olympics, and then all of the games in December started getting postponed. And also, China is not very high on the list of millionaires countries they like to be quarantined in.
Yeah.
So the NHL pulls out, and now the U.S. and Canadian Olympic committees basically have two options to fill the rosters. Either you go for, like, remember some guys type
40-year-old
names.
Derek Roy.
who have washed up in, like, the DEL, which is, like, the old man league, basically. Or, like, the AHL or the ECHL, like, Bobby Ryan might be an option. And
Bobby Ryan.
Steve Kampfer was on the list of the invites that they've issued already. So that's who they mostly built the team of in 18, but that didn't go very well. So It's going to be heavier on college players. Last time around, they only had a couple. Jordan Greenway and Troy Terry, I think, were like two of the four. It sounds like it's probably going to be 50-50 from those two pools. So that's 10 to 12 guys.
Okay.
And, you know, they're not going to pull, you know, I don't know, insert a name here, right? Like, they're not going to pull Marc Estapa. Like, they're going to go with...
probably not.
...the elite NHL prospects to fill those pools. So
who from Michigan is probably going to be gone?
So we know that Power has allegedly accepted a...
Allegedly because it's not official.
It's not official, but it's been reported in Sportsnet.
Okay.
Beniers has been invited, we know, and we also know there is a very high probability that everyone invited will accept. So, you know, those two made a lot of sense also because those guys both, number one, have more polished games. Number two, they are both guys who played in the World Championships back in May, which means they've already played against men.
Okay.
Which is a big deal. So those two guys were obvious. The report yesterday is that Brendan Bisson has been contacted, but we don't know if that's the same as an invite.
Hmm. To camp or to the team?
There's nothing. There's going to be a camp. I think you just show up.
You just 25 guys. You here? Yeah. Are you in? You in or you're out right now?
They're in communication with him. You know, Bordalo is a name that would not shock me. I mean, that's a bit of a wild card because he's missed two World Juniors in a row.
And he hasn't played in a month.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one. Kent Johnson was on the long list of possible names, but that was like 40 names. So being on that list is only so important. I mean, it wouldn't shock me for him because, you know, if you're pulling the Steve Kampfers of the world out of the DEL, you're going to be lacking NHL skill.
Yeah.
And Johnson would be your opportunity to get that. So those are all the names that I think are going to be there. I mean, yeah, you could consider Luke Hughes, but number one, he's young. Number two, he's never played against men. Number three, he's sort of physically not that body yet, very skinny. Yeah. He plays a style that hockey men have a bias against. So that one seems like a long shot to me.
And no on Portillo.
I haven't heard anything about Sweden. What I know about Swedish hockey is that they have a bias against young guys in general. The sort of 19-year-old phenom prospects do not play much in the Swedish leagues. I mean, Lucas Raymond is playing more this season in the NHL than he did last year in SHL.
Which is weird.
So I would think that's a bias against Portillo there.
And then what about Minnesota?
Well, also we should shout out Straussman has already been invited to be on the U.S. team, which I assume is more enticing than playing 2 weeks for Skellefteå in the SHL.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're probably going to have some sun now.
Unless
right?
he's like banking on going in 26 when he's the Vezina Trophy winner.
Is this a drain prediction?
But, so, yeah, Strauss will be there. But anyway, Minnesota, there's already been three invites. Ben Myers, who is their face-off ace. Mm-hmm. Brock Faber, who is probably like their number one defenseman. Mm-hmm. And then Matty Nyes, who obviously has had a great freshman season for them. So that's their three. I don't know if there'd be anyone else. I mean, obviously Chaz Lucius comes to mind, but he's had kind of an up-and-down, injury-riddled freshman year. And again, it doesn't seem like U.S. is going to go crazy on the prospects, so I would think that's probably it from them. But if you're talking about losing like your best scoring forward, your number one defenseman, your best faceoff guy, and also your goalie,
yeah, the goalie thing changes it. I think we saw last year you can take three of their defensemen off the ice and they won't even notice. So that one doesn't really that doesn't seem like it would impact them quite as much. Also, like, you don't have to play six defensemen. You can play four or five defensemen.
I think the Nyes one is the biggest.
Yeah. Well, he's their probably most talented player, I would say, right? Him or Lucius.
Him or Lucius, yeah.
So
I think Lucius probably has more talent, but Nyes is more polished.
So it really comes down to, if Michigan loses Beniers and Power, that sucks. But they also only play Michigan State and Ohio State for sure.
The good news,
Notre Dame series is 50-50 depending on how far teams go.
The good news is you're playing two teams during that period that you can very much like trot out the Jacob Hayhursts and try and like win 2-1. Like that's a very viable path and to beating those two teams.
Three of those four games are at Yost.
Yeah, which hasn't necessarily been a good thing this year, but
well, but it's better than playing on some ice slop in Columbus, and like I still hate going to Mon. The fourth game then is at LCA, which okay, like that's fine. Then
for the Iron D.
Yes, of course. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah.
And then the last series would be in South Bend, which would potentially be for wrapping up the Big Ten, depending on where you're at in the standings. So you'd like to have them back by then.
So here's what you do. You get to first place by the end of January. Then you get COVID during the Olympics. And then you come back and you play Notre Dame.
Well, oh, it would go on like points percentage?
Yeah.
Is that what it would be?
Yeah, that's what they've said. If there are any postponements, it's going off of point percentage.
There you go. I think you've planned it out. Yeah.
But so they have to report on February 1st, or mm-hmm. the start of February. That's what the Grand Forks Herald said. So,
which is where we all turn for our news.
that's the only article that has talked about it. So,
okay,
because they were Sanderson was picked for the
right.
U.S. team. So sure. Anyway, so you report first week of February. They don't play my birthday weekend, the February 5th through the 7th. That's the USNTDP weekend, which
right.
is actually like a Wednesday, so they don't play during the weekend.
Yeah.
So you're losing them for 3 weekends, and one of them you don't play. So that's kind of optimal to begin with. And if you're only losing them those 2 weekends, I mean, sure. I've heard the argument that the program believes going to these tournaments sharpens them and they come back better, and that's why Michigan's gotten better after in the second half of the season. At least that's what some people connected to the program have told me.
That seems like a really good PR statement, but sure.
You know, for me, it's just the big risk that the IOC has basically said that if you test positive during the Olympics, it's a 3 to 5 week quarantine period, which seems very excessive given the CDC is saying a 5 day quarantine period, but that would be the concern.
Well, and it's China.
If it's
I mean, there
have
been issues there before with,
right.
like, just people going in and out of the country. So, and now you're in a heightened state of alert with all this other stuff. So, it's just it's a risky scenario. The interesting thing for me is, like, it seemed like most of these players, or the players that were in question, a lot of them were, we weren't sure if they were going to come back. We were leaning to them because of their personal situations and where they were drafted and where those teams were. But they could have gone to the AHL. And a lot of these players seem to come back because either they wanted to play at Michigan, they liked it here, or they want to win a national title.
So
leaving for a critical part of the season seems to contradict some of those goals.
I think the argument from their standpoint is we're still going to be back for March, because obviously you sort of believe you're invincible.
Sure.
Especially at that age.
And no one can keep me in a country if I don't want to be.
It'd be very fun if several players test positive, and then we have to get, like, Mel to fly a plane over there, and we have to airlift them out.
This feels like a movie. But you are sort of a screenwriter, aren't you? We won't tip that hand yet.
So, anyway,
I don't know if I'd go with fun.
The other part about it is that, you know, what's the probability that all of these players are going to be back there and, you know, in the Olympics in the future? Number one, it's not clear at which point the NHL will ever go back to the Olympics. I mean, the players made it a very big bargaining piece in the last CBA, which is why they had carved out the time, and they, by all accounts, were going to go prior to Omicron. But you never know. League business changes in a hurry, and we know from league negotiations that it's basically, like, to Gary Bettman, it's the equivalent of murdering his dog in front of him. Like, he wants the players to go to the Olympics over his dead body, more or less. So it will always be a tricky obstacle. And even if, let's say, the NHL are going in 26 and in 30, you know, what's probably these guys are going to be here? I mean, you have to be you know, all NHL, Norris Trophy, Vezina Trophy caliber players to be invited to teams like the U.S. and Canada, right? Like,
well, I think that if you're talking about...
If you're Latvian, like, you're going to be at the Olympics until you're 45.
Sam Ozilinch is probably still on the team.
But if you are Owen Power or whoever, like, you have to really, really be a very, very good player to get to that point. Like, if we were doing the NHL at the Olympics, there would be, what, two Michigan guys on any teams? Probably Connor and Larkin, and that's it. Maybe Werenski on the U.S. team, maybe Hughes. But
Pacioretty?
Maybe. I mean, it's not... You sit down and you actually make these rosters. These teams, Canada and the U.S., have a lot of really, really good players. Like, it's not just, oh, you have a good NHL career. You have to be in the conversation for scoring titles or Norris trophies to be on that team.
If you're talking about Beniers or Power, I think there is a decent chance that one of them or both of them could make an Olympic team. I think if you're looking at anyone below that caliber of, like, you get down to sort of like the Bortolo and Brassans, who are good players but probably not at the same level as Beniers and Power. Maybe Kent Johnson, is he sort of like the wild card where you're like, he has the ability you can see to be some sort of a superstar, or he could just be a piece on a team. Those guys, I would say, yeah, this is your shot. The Beniers and Power, you know, if their career projects the way that we seem to think it could or should or whatever, then yeah, they might have a chance in one of the next two. But yeah, anyone below that, I would say, you know, if this is on your list and you want to do this, this is probably your time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bird in the hand, where, you know, versus two in the bush, or two in the hand is one of
whatever
the hell that saying is.
The
point is, even if you are really cocky and you believe that, like, I'm, you know...
Like you.
Like, if you're a player and you're like, in 4 years I'm guaranteed to be a Hart Trophy candidate. Like, even if you believe that, which there are not many players at age, like, 20 that could have said that.
Yeah.
You know, anything could happen. Like, right?
Hey,
like,
sure.
Sidney Crosby was this phenom, then he spent several years in the wasteland with concussions. Like, that can always happen. And being invited now is a better, like, you, this is your actual material chance and not a hypothetical chance.
It's also
in the future.
It's also a weird Olympics.
Yeah.
Because it's not like the 2010 Olympics, or even a little bit like the 2014 Olympics, which were very hyped with the NHL players and everything. I mean, I remember almost nothing about the 2018 hockey tournament, I mean, on the men's side, because like you said, you named one or two players off of that team, and I think Germany was in the gold medal game.
I know Russia won gold.
Probably, because
they had Kovalchuk and Datsyuk.
Sure.
But
that's what I mean, is like, yeah, I'm not saying that you can't go, I'm not saying that they shouldn't or there shouldn't be allowed or any of those
things.
Well,
I think the other argument,
what I'm saying is, like,
too, is you get a lot of really good press from doing it. I mean, the fact is that...
Okay, but
like,
they're top five picks.
Well, Owen Power is going to get a ton of coverage on Sportsnet and on TSN because he's going to be, like, the focal point of the Canadian team. Like, they are going to want the ratings to go up, so they're going to get, you know, Power and maybe Mason McTavish and a few other top prospects to kind of juice interest, and you'll be a recipient of that interest. So,
how interested are you in this Olympic tournament?
I'm more interested than...
Michigan players aside.
I'm more interested than 2018. I mean...
Which is like, maybe I'll turn it on if Luge is over?
I mean, you know, I'll tune in for some of the games, but it depends on how interesting they are.
Yeah. I might be more interested if there are Michigan players, but even then, I don't know.
It's a bummer that the NHL isn't there. That's
exactly
what we'll say.
I agree. Anything else that we need to get to?
Not really.
I feel like this segment has run a little long.
Well, there was a lot to talk about.
There was. We took a long break, and now you have multiple workouts that you can listen to us talk during.
Thank you for listening to Michigan Hockey Cast 4.12. For Alex Tran, David Nasternak, come back next week where there might be a little bit of Australian Open coverage.